The following program is being brought to you on the Seventh Wave Network. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit SeventhWaveNetwork.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit VoiceAmerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
I seek truth, no use sits within me. How deep would I go to find what I know about me? You don't know me like God does, like I do. I'm training myself to know how to sing, trust myself, believing everything that I know. I can keep up with my mind.
Welcome to Thresholds to Awakening with your host, Sway Emily Spilkin. Deep inside our greatest challenges live the seeds of our soul medicine. Illness, trauma, loss, and crisis, if we enter them completely, can be gateways to the full embodiment of who we really are. Now, here is Sway Spilkin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Thresholds to Awakening. I am your host, Sway Spilkin, and I'm a body and soul-centered psychotherapist and healer in Boulder, Colorado, specializing in helping people transform through the thresholds of their lives. And today I have the great honor and joy of interviewing Mirabai Starr, author of The God of Love, A Guide to the Heart of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and translator of the critically acclaimed new translations of the mystics, including The Dark Night of the Soul and Teresa of Avila. Mirabai Starr uses fresh lyrical language to help make timeless wisdom accessible to a contemporary circle of seekers. Mirabai has been an adjunct professor of philosophy and world religions at the University of New Mexico Taos since 1993, and she speaks and teaches nationally and internationally on the teachings of the mystics and contemplative practice, and is also a certified bereavement counselor. She lives in the mountains of northern New Mexico with her husband, and between them, Mirabai and Jeff have four grown daughters and six grandchildren. And Mirabai's youngest daughter, Jenny, was killed in a car accident in 2001 at the age of 14. And on that same day, Mirabai's first book, a translation of The Dark Night of the Soul, was released. She considers this experience and the connection between profound loss and longing for God the ground of her own spiritual life. Mirabai can be found on the web at www.mirabaistarr.com. Welcome to the show, Mirabai.
Thank you, Sway. What a delight to be here. I can't believe there's a whole show dedicated to the thing that's most important to my life.
Now. Yes. Amazing. Yeah, it is. There are a handful of us, I think, that, you know, happen to be on this particular path, and and somehow we find each other. So I'm really glad to, you know, have the honor of having you on the show here today.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if we could start today by you describing a little bit about your spirituality, which is really the, you know, central focus of your life. And could you tell us a little bit about what are the traditions that you are immersed in now and how you found your way to your particular path?
That's funny because I just have been traveling all over the place. In fact, I'm sitting right now in a parking lot at the airport, having just arrived from I don't even remember where. And I've just been traveling around the country, in fact, the hemisphere, talking about the path of interspirituality. And so really the answer is I'm a Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, Sufi who loves Christ. There's some pagan in there too, actually. So my spiritual path is really one of walking and sitting in many different religious and spiritual traditions. And I was kind of formed that way because when I was a young teenager, I lived at the Lama Foundation in New Mexico. Most of your listeners will know that as perhaps as the place where Ram Dass wrote Be Here Now, which was such a seminal book in the 1970 that really awakened the consciousness of the whole culture to Eastern thought in a way that it hadn't before, hadn't been happening yet before. So that was Lama was and continues to be a true interspiritual center where all of the world's spiritual paths are studied and practiced and celebrated. And so they were all presented to me as being kind of equal value. Mm. And I grew up thinking that everybody was one of each. Mm. So as I have gotten older, maybe I've come a little bit more to rest in my root tradition of Judaism, although my parents were not only secular, non-religious Jews, but they were very anti-religion. So they were Jewish culturally, but very much against institutionalized religion on the grounds, you know, that organized institutionalized religion was responsible for a lot of the suffering on the planet, which is kind of hard to argue with, but the baby they threw out with that bathwater was spirituality, and I mean, they didn't really, they were very spiritually oriented, but I have rediscovered the jewels in all of the world's great religions that I wouldn't have known was there if I had gone along with what my family, you know, believed and felt. But as you mentioned, my own particular personal losses brought me onto a spiritual path in a way that all of the practices I had ever done hadn't.
Mm. Yeah, and you know, when I'm looking forward to really diving deeper into that throughout this interview with you, as that's really you know, what I'm most interested in. And I'm wondering right here at the outset if you could maybe answer or shed some light on kind of a big question in relationship to that, and then we'll kind of go a little bit deeper into the dark night of the soul and go a little bit deeper into your personal journey with it. But the question goes something like this, you know, often when we face a big loss or a trauma, or even facing a global or community loss, like, you know, what's happening in Boston, what happened in Boston, there can be a tendency to use it as an opportunity to question our concept of the divine. And we can say, you know, well, how do I reconcile this with my vision of a benevolent or supportive God, or supportive, you know, beloved in your words, or, you know, in a more mystical way of framing it. How do I understand this terrible thing that's happened to me in the light of that? And somehow it can feel like a betrayal of the divine or beyond that. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little to that right here at the onset of how do we reconcile those two things, kind of being in relationship to a loving, benevolent divine, or our concept of that, and then facing kind of the unfaceable.
Right, exactly. Well, you know what, so many things. One thing is, maybe the most important thing for me, is that the divine, the sacred, ultimate reality for me has always been a profound mystery, mm-hmm. in the face of which I can only be in awe. Sometimes God for me takes the form of beloved, as you mentioned. There is this love longing in my heart for connection with the source of all love that might be called God. But there is also, there has always been in me a sense that ultimate reality or God, even my beloved, God as my beloved, as the beloved, is far more mysterious than any attempt I might make to personify or limit that vastness. And so I don't think that my 14-year-old daughter Jenny, as you mentioned, was killed in a car accident when she was 14, and it was at the end of October 2001, and it was a time of great suffering on the planet. It was shortly after 9/11, and we had just invaded Afghanistan and were ready to invade Iraq. And I had this very visceral sense of the suffering of mothers everywhere in the world at that time. And in fact, going backwards and forwards in time. In other words, my membership in the tribe of women of children who had died was really, it was in my body. I actually had a moment in which it flooded through me, and I realized that as alone as I felt in the depths of the fire of my loss and my grief, I was interconnected in a way that I had never felt before. So the mystical path seems to be all about paradox, that, you know, God, who is intimately beloved and so profoundly beyond all conception, the vast mystery that it cannot possibly be confined. So I didn't feel betrayed in any way by a personified dude called God who had, you know, done me wrong. But I did feel that there was nowhere to go. None of my spiritual practices held me up. Nothing I had ever done to feel the presence of the sacred was working. And in fact, it was all backfiring. And not only could I not feel the presence of the divine with me, but I couldn't. None of the concepts were working. Everything sounded like empty platitudes. I mean, I kind of had that tendency anyway to feel that the sacred could not be defined or confined. But boy, a tragic loss just collapsed any last props that may have been there and set them all on fire. And so I think that years of meditation practice, of just sitting in the silence and learning not to believe everything I think, maybe saved me more than anything. Of course, I couldn't meditate in those first few weeks or months after Jenny died. But I think that having had a contemplative practice for so long, my being knew just enough to be able to be a little tiny bit present to what was happening, to not check out, to not turn away, but to quietly sit with the unbearable. And I think many of your listeners and you can relate to that. I mean, of course, where else are you going to go? But people do check out. They do, you know, drugs and shopping and whatever your compulsions or addictions, favorite compulsions and addictions may be, and I have mine, but there was something in me that knew that if I did that, if I checked out, even what my friend Ted Wired, who's a grief counselor, calls a spiritual bypass, even if I used spirituality and religion to check out, if I checked out in any way, I was going to be missing a profound opportunity. I don't know, not like it was a good thing I was getting to have, but it was it was something I was supposed to do. I was supposed to sit in the fire. And then I realized, and it may be that it was later. No, it was at the time. Definitely at the time. I realized that I was sitting in that fire for Jenny. It was my way of honoring her was to show up for what was happening and not miss it. Yeah.
You know, as you're speaking here, I have big chills, and I felt it also when you spoke about the lineage of women past and future who have endured this kind of loss of a child. And there's a sense, as you're talking, of almost intimacy. It is intimacy, that sense of, okay, well, I'm choosing to be present in this fire and not turn away, because there is a intimacy both with Jenny and her process and with all of those who've experienced this and with the divine in that moment that it's opening to you to, and that you're in service of that intimacy above being in service of being out of pain.
Gosh, that was so beautifully said. Thank you. Beautiful.
And do you, thank you, do you think that that is something that one is just born with? You know, you spoke in the beginning, so you said something, I wish I had gotten the phrasing down, something about the longing in your heart and the way that you said it. I just thought, oh, that's so beautiful, that quality. And is that something that, how does that develop? You know, I'm thinking of people in the, you know, who face challenge and they might just not have that muscle yet, or the longing to be intimate with what is not stronger. Not that it necessarily should be. I mean, this pain is unbearable. But I'm wondering, is that something that you is developable through practice, or is that longing just innate? How do you describe that?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. You know, I work a lot with bereaved family members, and not even just, I work a lot with people in loss, not only through death, but people who have had any kind of, shattering loss, maybe of their own health or of a community that was deeply important in their lives, a job, a career, a relationship. Boy, that's a painful, shattering loss. Anything that shatters our identity. So I work with people in that identity shattered state. And often I find that when I invite them into the stillness, that is what naturally bubbles up in the heart, is this profound and inextricable connection between missing the one we love who we've lost, or that which we have lost, and our longing for God, for the divine, that it comes, that arises naturally in almost everybody in the stillness. So I really emphasize gentle contemplative practice as a tool for accessing that sacred suchness that is, as you say, that medicine. But Rumi, I love that Rumi quote in the poem that Elise Coleman Barks translates as "My Worst Habit," and the line is, "There is a secret medicine only to those who hurt so hard they cannot hope. The hopers would feel slighted if they knew. There is a secret medicine given only to those who hurt so hard they cannot hope. The hopers would feel slighted if they knew." And that secret medicine, that elixir, it arises from the very deepest, darkest ground of our being, and the only way to make a place for that is to be still. And that's the hardest thing to do when you're on fire. And, you know, it's like we're wired for fight or flight, right? As a psychotherapist, you have a much better languaging for this and the neurological explanation, but I know enough to know that when we're confronted with something dangerous and terrible, we want to either push up against it or get out of there. And I am inviting people to do the counterintuitive thing, as are many, many other people. Pema Chodron is famous for this teaching in her work. Instead of running away, instead of pushing away, to sit gently and compassionately, not like to white knuckle it and grit your teeth and say, okay, I can do this, I can bear the unbearable, because you can't, we can't. But it's a matter of softening into it with a very tender, respectful, caring for ourselves and for whatever it is that we're honoring, whoever it is that we're honoring in that process. And so I also want to work with people, in addition to contemplative practice, very, very small steps and sips of that, by the way, of that quiet, is I introduce sacred poetry from all the different traditions. Mm-hmm. You know, from Rumi to Mary Oliver to Rilke to St. John of the Cross, and just read these beautiful sacred words about from other beings who have been able to be transformed by their encounter with the mystery. So my approach is contemplative rather than cathartic. And I don't think you have to be born that way. I think we can do that for one another by just bearing loving witness and reading poetry to each other and sitting quietly with each other.
You know, as you say that, I get the sense that by going through the fire and facing it and becoming intimate with what is and bearing the unbearable, or not bearing the unbearable, but letting it break us open, we get turned into that elixir, you know? It's like our very being becomes nectar, and or can, not always, but can.
Right.
And that you know, when you read the poems to the people that you're working with, it's food for them because of the way that those people have been tempered by their own lives. And so then that nectar is able to come through, and that you in your life, that, you know, part of your service is to have become this nectar.
Ojalá, as they say in Spanish, if only. I hope so.
You know, I have a question that feels a little sensitive, so I want to be kind of careful about how I phrase this, but I've interviewed people on the show who have a certain framework that, okay, you know, before we're born, we choose a particular pathway in order to learn particular lessons, right? And so there's some kind of conscious choice about choosing our challenges so that we will become that food and service to others. Mm-hmm. It's a tricky framework to hold because it can easily kind of slip into blame, or assigning more power than we actually have,
right?
Which is magical thinking.
Right.
But I'm wondering how you relate to that concept, if at all. You know, I'm in the story of your daughter's death. You know, I was reading that, and as I said in the introduction, that kind of unbelievable coming together of the publishing of your book, of, you know, your book arriving on your doorstep a half hour of, you know, of Dark Night of the Soul, the translation, a half hour before you had heard the news, found out that Jenny had been killed, and something about those things coinciding, there's a sense of, oh, is there some orchestration here? Is there something larger? And I'm just wondering how you relate to that concept.
Yeah. No, that's a perfectly valid question. And it is fairly extraordinary in this case, and so it's worth looking at. You know, I started writing a blog a few years ago, and it began as a grief blog, and it's now kind of morphed into more writings on interspirituality, which is kind of where my path is leading me, although grief work will always be part of everything I do. But in one of the earlier posts, if anyone wanted to look for it, there's the first, you know, 20 or more posts are on the transformational power of grief, or grief as a spiritual path, really. And there's one called something like Believing Everything. Because when Jenny died, of course, my little mind was very busy, because that's what minds are designed to do, right? I mean, brains, anyway, are designed to solve problems. And this was a big problem. My daughter was dead. And everything in me was trying to figure it out, even though I knew it could not be figured out. Like, I knew that was futile, but it's like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stage of bargaining. You just have to go through it, and it has to run its course, the bargaining thing, all that little monkey chatter that's just going to keep rewinding the tape, hoping that you can make the story come out different somehow by retelling it to yourself a thousand times. And so one of the ways I bargained my way through those early stages of grief was trying to understand why it happened and now what. Like, where was Jenny? Who was Jenny? Was she going to reincarnate? Because I had certainly been on a yogic path for long enough that voice was in there. Was she going to, is she merging with all that is back to her source? Is she a spirit, like an angelic being available to me on my own path now? Is she there with me? And so I finally concluded, rather with great relief, actually, that it was all true simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And so one of the stories that got to be true during that process was that Jenny and I made an agreement before either of us were born that we were going to do this dance in this lifetime, and that it was for the greatest good, not of only of ourselves, but of whoever got to be affected by us in some way. And so I don't blithely believe this, but I add it to the full array of possibilities of what is true. Because, as you said, so for your listeners who don't know, Dark Night of the Soul by the 16th century Spanish mystic St. John of the Cross is really the articulation of the transformational power of suffering. Mm-hmm. And that book literally came, my first advance copy, as you said, arrived by UPS at my door. We live rurally in the mountains of northern New Mexico. And a half an hour later, the police came to my door to tell me that my daughter had been killed in a car accident. And so what's up with that? Why? That I had done the first translation of this book in over 50 years, the third English translation ever, the first one certainly by a woman, the first one by someone outside the Catholic Church who was trying to present these teachings in a more accessible way to a more non-religious audience. And then here I was plunged into the deepest, darkest night of my soul that I could have ever imagined. So I don't know. It's as always, those two things have always been entwined for me. Jenny's death has informed all the work that I have done with these teachings of the Dark Night of the Soul, both internally and with others. And the Dark Night of the Soul has always, always informed my work with people in grief. Mm-hmm. And it's such a beautiful fit, because really the primary teaching of the Dark Night of the Soul is know nothing. Be in radical unknowingness. Because it is in that stripped down state, when all of our attachments and our concepts and our sensory ways of being with the sacred are all stripped, and we are in an absolutely naked state of soul. And so the Dark Night of the Soul teachings are about when that comes, and it's grace when it comes to St. John of the Cross, when we're brought to our knees and we're brought plunged into that emptiness. But grief and loss has a way of instantly taking us to that stripped down state that the mystics speak about as the required state for having union with God.
You know, I'm aware as you talk about that, I'm reminded of another interview that you did that I was listening to in preparation for this one, and how you spoke of a big piece of what was stripped, and you spoke of this earlier, was any concept you had of the divine, and it feels like beyond concept was any accessibility to it. That there, for you personally, in your dark night of the soul with Jenny's death, there was, because it was so beyond anything that you could fathom, there was a release of any idea and also any actual pathway or reaching to God was also not, or the divine was not really available to you in that moment. Do I have that right?
Yes. I mean, I think you and I spoke about that earlier, even just today, that at first I definitely didn't feel the loving presence of the divine. Mm-hmm. But I did feel right away the sacred. I mean, right away meaning within the first few hours. So I don't know if I could have said it. In fact, I'm pretty sure I couldn't have named it. But over those first few days, there was a pouring into the shattered container of my heart, of my entire being, a deep quiet and a profound holding. it was as if that, you know, and I hesitate to say I believe in angels per se, but it was like these angelic forces rushed in and held me aloft, or held me to some kind of breast where I took refuge, where I was, I wasn't safe, because the most dangerous thing had just happened. There was no safety, but there was this deep quiet and stillness and holiness. That's the word I'm looking for. There was this holiness. And everybody who walked into the house felt it, you know, as a non-religious Jew or from a non-religious Jewish family. I still wanted to, I was casting about for anything that could create some kind of container to put this in when Jenny died. And so some Jewish friends were more along the lines of Jewish renewal, which is a much more expansive form of Judaism than, say, Orthodox Judaism or even conservative or Reform Judaism, but some free-thinking Jewish friends taught me how to sit Shiva. So right away we did 7 days of sitting Shiva in our house and chanting the Kaddish every evening at sunset. People would pour into the house for this ritual. And also for the first 24 hours, we had Jenny's body with us. A friend built a beautiful, I call it a cradle. I guess it was a casket, an open casket of cedar wood. And another friend brought over a beautiful carved platform, a kind of table from Bali. And we put the casket on the table in our living room and covered it with flowers and sage and pinyon and greens and gifts. And Jenny's friends all came and put beautiful things in her casket with her, and we sang and chanted for around the clock and prayed with her body for 24 hours in different languages of all the different world religions, and as well as sitting Shiva in the Jewish tradition, and different people coming and blessing her body, different spiritual leaders. So the holiness was so palpable that it took people's breath away. And it takes mine away just remembering it. You know, I don't want people who are listening to this to go, gosh, I wish I had done something like that, and feel their loss even more acutely. You know, sometimes when I tell people about that, they feel even more sad that they didn't get to do that. But one of the things I do with people is we go back to the beginning when the loss first happened, and we explore it together, and then we create rituals to do. It's never too late to invent and create your own apothecary of healing rituals.
I really appreciate that. It's, you know, a lot of when I'm working with clients doing somatic trauma work, in a way it is that as well. There's a sense of how do we create what didn't get to be, so that there can be that opening that we long for. You know, ritual creates, it feels like an opening where we can be closer to the divine, where the veils get thinner by us putting ourselves in certain positions and doing certain prayers and opening in certain ways. You know, there's the pathways then become more open, and the energy can rush in of the divine, or the connection can be there. And I think it is, you know, a deep longing, even amongst those who don't know that they long for it, and that there's something really necessary about that in loss. And it isn't too late. It isn't ever too late. I think we're always waiting for that completion.
Yeah, yes. And I, you know, 11 years later, or 12 years almost, I continue to do rituals. All the time, and ritual may take the form of a project that you dedicate to your loved one, a race that you run. Oh, that's wrong metaphor right now, but yeah, something that you do that's difficult and challenging and wonderful that you do in honor of your loved one. That's a ritual. I remember going. My husband had a job in Hawaii, and the girls and I were with him in Hawaii right before Jenny died, he had a job, so we were able to be in this beautiful condo on the beach with him. And then, but it was the middle of the school year, so I had to get the girls back to school. So we were there for a week. We came home, and Jenny was killed 2 days later, and Jeff was still there in Hawaii. And so it took him, I don't know, almost 20 hours to get home. And then about 10 days later, we had just had the memorial. His company said, I don't know, might have been even earlier that they said this, who knows, I was so shattered, I had no idea what was going on, but they invited him to come back to complete the job. They put it on hold and paid my way too. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like the right thing to just get out of town and just get away. And then one of the things we did when we were there is that we hiked into the wilderness in Maui to a place where where you can jump off a cliff 40 feet into a volcanic pool. Mm-hmm. And then once you get into that pool, you have to swim across it about, 50 yards maybe, to another pool, and you jump off again, and there were 7 of them. And mm-hmm. I am not a swimmer, nor particularly crazy about jumping great heights. But I did it for Jenny. It was terrifying, exhilarating, amazing experience. And I could only do it because I didn't care what happened to me. Mm. In fact, if I died, that would be fine with me at that moment. Mm. And I don't feel that way anymore, but I did. Mm. And it was, and I remember jumping off that cliff and screaming, "This is for you, Jen." Mm. And my whole being just exploding with something like joy. Mm. I mean, those moments of connectedness don't last when you're freshly grieving, but they do come. There are moments of profound peace that come, moments of deep connectedness. They come and then they go, mm. and when they go, it's grief all over again.
Mm. I'm feeling the just the beauty of that story and feeling the aliveness as you're describing, you know, in that moment. And you used a term, I'm not going to get it exactly right, but it was something like, you said, oh, something terrible and wonderful, or, you know, there was this, there's a paradox in that. There's a sense
terrible
of...
Terrible and beautiful, anyway.
Terrible
for sure.
And beautiful, right. Terrible, yeah. And beautiful. And in terms of, or the jumping off, you know, your actual experience of the, you know, kind of like, oh, this
yeah.
is, this is awful and exhilarating at the same time. And and your poem, you have a poem on your website that is your eulogy to Jenny, and I was reading through it, and there's this line that struck me. I'm going to see if I can... You say, I'll read it. "Make space, O life, open impossibly like the Red Sea, and make way for the miracle of this loss. I cannot accommodate it except by magic. I am swallowed and swallowed whole. I am on fire. I am flame. I am broken and I am broken, even as my child has become perfect." And that passage for me holds this sense of, you know, the miracle of this loss.
Right.
There's the sense of the terrible beauty, you know, of course it was nothing that you ever would have wished for, and there's nothing, you know, quote, positive about it, and yet there's this kind of paradoxical grace, beauty, opening that can happen in the midst of it.
Yeah, exactly. I was actually brought to tears by hearing you read my poem to me just now, and so I'm feeling in a very tender space at this moment. But because I was remembering, I mean, that was only a few days. I wrote that like 6 days after Jenny died, and I'm just looking back at that poor dear little Mirabai, this you know, this mother who had just. Who was just traumatized by the loss of her child, and I feel such compassion for that Mirabai. But yes, that something in me, I guess, must have recognized even then the terrible, awesome beauty of death. I mean, death, it is the ultimate kind of human encounter with mystery, and and the mystery is the closest we get to God somehow. So I think right from the beginning there was that my experience was washed with the sense of the sacred. So you just reminded me of that.
Thanks for bringing the tenderness here to us in this moment. And, you know, it's very, I can feel that portal, you know, even as you bring your emotion and your heart in this moment. I can feel that
vulnerability.
Yeah, exactly.
There's nothing to lose, you know.
Yeah.
I'm sitting in my car. You would never know I was crying if I didn't tell you, but it's worth mentioning.
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, I firmly believe and deeply experience our heart and our emotion and in all of its states as the opening, you know, one of the openings to the mystery.
Yeah. Yes, me too.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, I'd love to take a little bit of time here, kind of just switch gears slightly and speak a bit about, we've already spoken a bit, but a bit more about The Dark Night of the Soul, translation, the book, and if you can, and also how, you know, kind of what was John of the Cross's journey for people who don't know, and what does that look like in our own lives, and what can we take from the way in which he was in the fire?
Great. Okay, great. You know, when I first encountered John of the Cross, I was in college doing a semester abroad in Spain, my junior year in college, and I had already been introduced to Rumi, even though Robert Bly and Coleman Barks and others had not yet translated Rumi into English. There was the only English translation was a rather stilted British translation, beautiful but not very accessible. But I had learned about Rumi as a Sufi, not so much as a poet, but as a Sufi master. And when I was 18, so I was 20 and I was in Spain, and I found St. John of the Cross because I was studying Spanish literature. And when I first read St. John of the Cross in Spanish, his poetry, he's the patron saint of literature, I was amazed. He sounded exactly like Rumi. I said, this is the Rumi of Spain. So he was a raving mystic, just like Rumi, who wrote these ecstatic love poems to God. He also wrote prose treatises only because he was, his followers begged him to try to explain these ecstatic love poems, mystical poems, in some kind of theological terms that they could use to follow their own spiritual path, because his poetry was all metaphors for cultivating a relationship with God, an inner life. And so Dark Night of the Soul began as a poem, and then he wrote a 200-page prose commentary. And it's all about, as I said earlier, being in this stripped-down state so that you can have a direct encounter with God. I mean, that's what it means to be a mystic. Mysticism is about direct relationship with the divine, unmediated through ceremony or ritual or authority figures or any kind of prescribed dogma or ritual. So, although ritual can get you there, but then you have to step through the doorway into the unknown where the real thing happens. So it's all about radical unknowingness and the necessity of being with not knowing. So St. John of the Cross says that there are two parts of the Dark Night of the Soul. The first part is sensory, and the second part is what he calls spiritual, but it really means conceptual. In the first part of the Dark Night of the Soul, we may notice, and he says this could be, and often is, completely invisible to anyone else. It's a deeply private inner state. It's a spiritual crisis, perhaps, but it doesn't necessarily get triggered by external circumstances. It may, but it's usually not. It's usually something that we just little by little along our spiritual path may begin to notice that it's starting to feel really empty. And the things that used to uplift us and make us feel the presence of God, like singing, chanting, different kinds of spiritual practices, are no longer giving us the juice that they used to. And then if we are able to sit with that and allow ourselves to stay present with that dryness, then we kind of graduate into this conceptual night where even any ideas about God or the divine begin to become meaningless. And we are left with this state of radical unknowingness. We're not feeling God anymore, and none of our religious concepts make any sense anymore. And that is a true dark night of the soul. St. John of the Cross says that this, even though it doesn't feel good, and we think we're doing something wrong, or worse, that God has given up on us, abandoned us, he said what's actually happening is that we're being given this tremendous grace, that God, it's like we're being weaned from the divine breasts, he says, and we're going to throw a tantrum, we're going to have a little spiritual meltdown and protest. But what's happening is God sees that we have grown strong enough to walk on our own two spiritual feet and to eat what he calls the crusty bread of the robust grown-up. Mm-hmm. And that is when we're able to have a face-to-face direct encounter with God, mm-hmm. where we're not being led along, but we are standing up and saying, here I am, take me. And it's a very intimate, deep, and beautiful union that can happen, but only when we have left behind all of our attachments that have become obstacles to that direct encounter. Mm-hmm. And so he says that in the depths of the dark night, if we're still, if we don't turn away from it, if we breathe into it, sounds so Buddhist, then we are able to notice, he calls it, that there is this sweet, ineffable sweetness that begins to seep in through the darkness and fill us. And it's sweeter than anything we ever could have had through our own effort. It's only when our cup has been scrubbed clean by this fire, and we're able to be still and allow ourselves to sit in the emptiness, that we are then filled with this beautiful, sacred sweetness of God's love. And so you can see why I've made that connection between the dark night of the soul and grief, because grief is that holy fire that comes pouring in and empties the cup of our hearts. And it is into that emptiness that this love can come pouring. And I know that there are people probably saying, oh, sure, please, or even switching off the radio at this point, because it almost seems like blasphemy, or one of those terrible platitudes people say when they say things like, it's all part of God's plan, or God needed her more than you did. There is nothing platitudinous about this, I promise, because it's not me saying this is the way it is. It's about an invitation to know nothing. And that's what St. John of the Cross gives us. He gives us, paradoxically, an exquisite language for unknowing, for getting out of our own way.
There's such a light fullness when you describe that state. You know, first and I know the state isn't the point, but in that, you know, grace that floods in, you know, first there's that, as you describe St. John's, you know, journey, there's the stripping away and the inaccessibility of all the ways that have gone before. And then there's something in him, or something in us, if we put, you know, in our own journeys, that says okay, and still turns towards when we can't feel ourselves being met anymore.
Right.
But we still, there's some will, some longing, some, I don't know, some force in us that has us still turn towards, even though there's no evidence, sensory or conceptual evidence, that there's anything there to meet us. And in that,
yeah.
In that moment, however long that moment takes, is then when the true not knowing of the divine can create more intimacy. And then in what you describe, there's such a a quality of sweetness or grace or, you know, the splendors or, you know, however you want to name it, that's like, oh, this is different. This couldn't have been reached the other way.
Yeah, yeah, right, through our own efforts.
Yeah.
Yes, you so get this way. I love talking to you.
Thank you.
And St. Teresa of Avila, who was really St. John of the Cross's mentor, she was older than he was, and he was her partner in her Carmelite reform movement. She had very similar languaging. It's different in some ways because it's very feminine, her version, but, you know, she talks about drawing water from the well and using a noisy crank and hauling it up and doing it all ourselves to water the little plants in our garden. And she talks about all these different metaphors of getting water to the garden and aqueducts and engineered, you know, kinds of systems. And finally, there's the grace of rain, of gentle rainfall. And that's the way the garden is best watered. And that's what the way our souls find rest is, in not trying and struggling to feel and experience God or to make sense of that which makes no sense, for instance, catastrophic loss. But when we can just be still and allow, that's when there's a place for the grace to come. And so if listeners don't want to start with Dark Night of the Soul, because it's a pretty heavy read, I mean, I think it's lyrical and beautiful, but it is, it's an intense mystical masterpiece. There's the Teresa of Avila books also that I translated, The Interior Castle and The Book of My Life, but Sounds True did a series with me of little kind of inspirational or devotional books, we call them, on different mystics. And I have one on John of the Cross and one on Teresa of Avila that really summarize for me the jewels of their teachings. Mm-hmm. One on Teresa of Avila coming out in the fall, actually. And then my new book, God of Love, has quite a bit about the transformational power of grief and loss. And I, of course, refer to the teachings of St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila as guides for grief as a spiritual path, really.
Mm. That's perfect. And I'm glad you mentioned that we're right in the, you know, last few minutes of the interview, and I wanted to make sure that people knew where to get more of you or where to, you know, kind of where to go next. So I'm glad you've pointed them to the Sounds True recordings and your new book. And I'm wondering in the last couple minutes here if there's anything else that, you know, kind of given the focus of this show and given what we've spoken about that you're up to that you want people to know about.
Well, you know, as I said, my path is kind of moving more from the teachings of the mystics and grief and loss, which, as I said, will always be part of everything I do, to this path of interspirituality, which is really this emerging consciousness, emerging in the larger culture. I think many of us have been on an interspiritual journey for decades, and probably many of your listeners, and I suspect you, you know, have been interested in and practiced multiple spiritual paths and Eastern traditions and the Western traditions. But there is now more and more this sense that what's going to save us as save humanity and save the planet in the face of the multiple environmental and social and economic human rights crises everywhere is not only learning to understand in order to tolerate and accept different religious and spiritual paths, but to actually mingle. Mm-hmm. So the inter-spiritual path is a little different than the interfaith path, where different ordained representatives from different traditions come together to have dialogue. Inter-spirituality is about allowing yourself to be transformed by your encounter with other people's spiritual paths and to experience them, to move from the head to the heart. And this has profound implications for those of us who are grappling with grief and loss, because there are so many spiritual tools and technologies available to us through the world's great religious traditions that can help us in our times of greatest need. And if we just stick with one tradition, because we're afraid that we're going to be, you know, betraying some kind of faith covenant if we practice in other holy houses, we may be missing really important opportunities for healing and transformation that are available in these other areas. So, for instance, when I do grief work with people, we do chanting in different religious traditions and prayers from different traditions and practices from different traditions, all of which together make a huge difference in our ability to both heal from and be with our loss.
Beautiful. Well, thank you for sharing everything that you've shared with us today in this interview, Mirabai, and thank you for your dedication to your work in the world and the way that it is serving. And it's really been a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, thank you. It's just been wonderful talking with you. I feel so connected.
I feel that way as well. So thank you so much. I'm going to give your website again, which is www.mirabaistar.com. And I can be found on the Facebook fan page. You can find the Thresholds to Awakening fan page and like us there, or my website, thresholdshealing.com. And we'll talk to you next time. Thank you.
Bye, Clay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you again for joining us this week. Thresholds to Awakening can be heard live every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific Time, on the Voice America 7th Wave Channel. Please join Sway Emily Spilkin then, and have a great week.